This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This is the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your social media feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, author of the novel Brotherless Night. And today, my co-host Whitney Terrell has the day off, but I'm joined by Jen Silverman, the author of the terrific new novel There's Going to Be Trouble. Jen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Jen, how did you first get involved in politics and activism? How did you first start to care about it? Did you kind of follow in someone's footsteps, or were you trying to break away, or something in between?
You know, I'm not even sure that I would say I'm involved so much as I'm fascinated by it. I'm sort of an observer of most things. I mean, spoken like a child who was raised in many countries, right? But I've found what I find particularly fascinating are the moments, sort of galvanizing moments, in which all of a sudden people seem to be having the same conversation. There seems to be an electricity around that conversation, and then seeing what happens, right? And so that's been something that I've been drawn to over the years.
And those moments, it seems to me, are rarer and rarer. I wonder, are you of an age where you ever saw an episode of Family Ties?
No, but I also wasn't raised fully in this country, so most references go over my head at a certain point.
So Family Ties was the sitcom that vaulted Michael J. Fox to stardom, kind of, I guess, prior to Back to the Future. And it was a show, and the premise of the show was essentially that, like, hippies had a Republican kid.
Sure.
And he kind of drove them up a tree. And for me, I feel like this show was, I mean, I wasn't a super fan or anything, but it was this show that was interesting because its premise inverted what people tended to assume about generational divides in politics, which are the topic of our show today. So in watching Family Ties, it was this, like, automatically comedic presence because, like, who would have a kid? It was more conservative than them. What a far-fetched notion. And
right.
And he played that little Republican figure so wholeheartedly, it, like, really was his ticket to being a household name, I guess. But it's really interesting to know that overseas, of course, this wouldn't have been a thing.
Right. Not the sitcom, although I'm sure there were, like, they have their own versions of it depending on the country. But I there is something really interesting in the States, particularly in sort of the, not just the generational divides, although definitely, but also the generational assumptions we make about who is going to fall where politically. And then when that gets upended, there's some, you know, pleasure or humor there often. But it makes me think about, you know, like, all of the kids of the hippie generation, like, some of them, the response to that collective scream for freedom was a collective scream for structure, right? So the pendulum swings.
It seems like it, but I was really interested because I was thinking about, I don't know, like, when I first got quote unquote involved in politics, maybe fascinated is a better description. I grew up outside DC in Bethesda, Maryland, so kind of in the world of feds and people who, I don't know, spoke congressional speak very fluently. But I think a lot of my earliest political information came from members of my family. And then when I did go looking for other sources, I was lucky to be in places where they weren't hard to find. So I wasn't exactly Alex P. Keaton, but I also wasn't following the mold. But it seems to me like these days, generational divides in politics are getting bigger and bigger. So, for example, like, a relatively recent Pew Research study was saying that, like, 25 years ago, which was 1999, voters in their 20s and voters in their 70s had, like, the same political split. So 52% of them were Democratic and 46% were Republican. But now, like, every decade, voters get even more progressive than the ones before. So not only is there this big generational divide, but it's actually getting bigger and bigger. Younger people are getting more and more and more and more progressive. So today's show is about these generational divides, and we're talking about your fabulous new novel, There's Going to Be Trouble, which everyone should read. It's so good. Everyone should read this book, and it has in it a father's political awakening and also his daughter's political awakening decades later. So before we get to this main conversation about the major splits between younger and older voters on issues like foreign aid and climate change, throwing our future and maybe our presidential election into question, I just want to read your bio. So There's Going to Be Trouble just came out. Your debut novel, We Play Ourselves, was a Lambda Literary Award finalist. Your story collection, The Island Dwellers, was longlisted for the Penn Robert W. Bingham Prize for Debut Fiction. And you're also the author of a poetry chapbook, Bath. John's honors include fellowships from McDowell, also a place I live, the NEA, and the Guggenheim Foundation. So, Jen, thank you so much for being here today to talk about your book.
Thank you so much for having me here. It's a pleasure.
So I love your book for so many reasons. And it alternates its point of view between a young man at Harvard in like the late 60s around the anti-Vietnam protests and political upheaval of that time, which was, of course, occurring in all places, like many places across the country during that period. And then his daughter's perspective on the yellow vest protests in France in 2018. So as we talk about these generational divides, we're going to talk about the book in a little bit, but I wanted to start off by asking you how you see generational divides in politics now, and then I'll be curious to hear how it relates to those time periods. Why do you think, like I was talking before about that Pew research, like why are younger voters getting more and more and more and more progressive, since apparently that seems to be new-ish?
Right. I mean, I don't have a good answer, but it's something that fascinates me. And I will also say, I think I would have had a different answer pre-2016 than I do now. It feels like, I mean, because the Republican Party, it feels like, has changed so drastically in terms of our understanding of it, its understanding of itself. I mean, in a way where Trump Republicans and Bush Republicans are not quite the same, you know, demographic, or I should say is not quite the same group of people, it seems like, in some ways. So my blanket statement is that I associate many of the Republican tenets in general with a kind of fear, a fear of the future, a desire to hold on to what's quote unquote safe, what's stable, a fear of other people. And I think younger people are not necessarily acting from a place of fear, right? Like, we get older, we become more afraid of the world. I mean, again, these are blanket statements, but just observationally, I think that a drive toward progressive politics is a drive toward wanting to change the world, wanting to remake the world, wanting a set of values that isn't based in fear. Where things get complicated is, I would say, the current Trump Republican Party is, you know, we've vaulted past fear into rampant hate. I mean, and those things aren't separate things. I mean, one is based in the other, but this, it gets a bit complicated there now, because I think there are ways in which I could have explained the quote unquote old Republican Party and this new one. To me, I mean, all of the historical parallels end up in really frightening places. But it makes sense to me when I talk to younger people that they aren't thinking, how can we hold on to what was stable ground underfoot? They're thinking, this is all a disaster. It's burning down. Like, what do we do about it? You know?
That's interesting because, yeah, their relationship to risk, I want to ask you about this a little bit later, but it does seem to me like one's age and one's relationship to risk, I maybe could have made a graph of that at some point. And then I feel like Trump and the pandemic and climate change have made my graph just really, like, it's not following the trend line I might have expected. So, I mean, speaking of, I don't know, kind of issues where people's feelings are driven by fear, I feel like the places where I see generational divides most sharply right now are in debates about Israel and Gaza, and in the rhetoric and activism around climate change. So, for example, for the first time last year, Gallup polling, last year they did a poll, and it was before October 7th, and it showed that Democratic voters were more sympathetic to Palestinians than Israelis. It was the first time Gallup data had ever shown that, and they'd been collecting data for like 20 years. And Politico attributed that to the party's younger leaders. And of course, you know, climate activists, like the most prominent climate activist in the world is probably Greta Thunberg, who is, I mean, was famous as a climate activist at like the age of 11 or 12. But then on the other hand, you've got some data that shows like the Harvard's Institute of Politics did a recent poll suggesting that less than half of young people plan to vote this fall. Data that really had me sweating. And of course, I think it's pretty clear that Joe Biden is in trouble with the young voters that under different circumstances and earlier times he could have perhaps counted on. So to me, this actually suggests that an engaged young person could be more likely to protest than vote. And I wonder what you think about that, how you see young people getting involved in politics, what's drawing them in and what's keeping them out.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back.
Yeah, well, all of this is complicated, of course, by the presence of social media, right? Which is a technology that when I was their age, we were not using it that way. We didn't have it that way, right? I mean, I remember being in college when Facebook was a thing that kids on college campuses were like, oh, hey, this is new. We can talk to our friends. It wasn't a tool of organization. It wasn't a political platform, right? So there's a way in which I think younger generations are turning to social media as a form of protest, or in their minds, in some minds, it is a singular tool of protest. And what worries me a little bit is twofold. And first, that the younger generation has lost any faith in the existing systems, the political systems, of which voting is sort of the, you know, primary example here, that they've lost faith that that will actually accomplish anything. And where their faith goes is toward the sort of immediacy and the reward of you post something on social media and a certain number of people respond and they repost and you're part of a very exciting tidal seeming conversation. But of course, what concerns me a little bit is where the participation in social media, you know, where that replaces or becomes both, you know, your political participation and also your protest participation, right? That the conversation on social media, I think, in some minds is the only conversation that you need to be having. And that's where I go, like, throughout much of the past several years, there's this refrain again and again that I see when I'm on social media, which is, you know, silence is complicity or silence is violence. And what they mean by that, often, silence equals not posting on Instagram, not responding to whatever's happening in the news in an immediate soundbitey way on Twitter, or, you know, like that there's, I think, less and less of an understanding that change does not always happen publicly and visibly and, you know, on a platform where it's easily and immediately viewed, and it takes time for things to change and shift. And sometimes that change requires participation in slow, grinding, brutal, unfair systems. I don't know. You know, like I also think there is a desire for things to be perfect, for there to be the perfect way to participate, the perfect way to protest, that there's a lot less, I think, patience and grace with imperfection and compromise, which I think that maybe also ties to technology. I don't know. These are so many separate thoughts, but it really fascinates me when I look at the way this world is structured now around a certain set of tools and how those tools both extend our reach and then also limit the imagination around that reach.
I'm really glad that you saw all of that because around social media, because I do feel like I also see the sort of silence as complicity thing. And of course, I feel like the place that that's most prevalent at the moment is with the conversation about Israel and Gaza. And my relationship to social media is very different than it was, say, 10 years ago. And I used to, often think through ideas on social media. And now I don't want to do that, really. And I'd rather do it in person, or do it, with a Zoom conversation, but not necessarily in the back and forth. And I think also that the conversation, people's ability to think through ideas is really compromised by a lot of people being afraid to speak openly in an atmosphere where if they make errors, going back to your point about imperfection, those errors will be called out in ways that make it hard for them to gracefully advance, perhaps.
Yes.
So.
Yes. And I also, I just don't, I think I have not yet seen an example. And look, life is long, I might see it. But I have not yet seen an example of anyone's mind being changed by short form. You know, like, I have not read a tweet that changed my mind about something that I thought I had a strong conviction about already. I haven't seen an Instagram post that made me rethink my entire political platform. Like, but conversations do that. If I'm in a long form personal conversation, or I'm listening to a podcast, or I'm reading somebody's book where they're advancing an argument, I might start by disagreeing. But as I think over time, durationally, with someone in person or with their body of work, that's how my mind changes and my horizons expand. So it also feels to me, in a sense, and I'm not, I don't want to denigrate social media, because it also, there's much that it does that is powerful. And as a tool of organization, I've seen it used very effectively. But as a tool of discourse, I'm not seeing it do much more than provide a sort of echo chamber inside which we're all just shouting, you know?
It seems to me like younger activists now, when they are using social media really effectively, what I see are videos of physical protests. So I'm remembering, I'm not remembering the name of this movement, I'll have to look it up for our show notes later, but there were a group of young climate activists who were doing things like disrupting billionaire social hours because, you know, people who had, I don't know, say were on the boards of oil companies or who had donated to questionable causes. And they were posting these and then they were sort of, you could see the generational divide, like an older person who feels like they've paid their political dues. Maybe they're hosting a political fundraiser or something, and they're yelling at the kid about, you know, their lack of manners. And the kid sort of being like, the world is burning and I'm going to have to be an adult in it. I'm going to be your age and the world will maybe not be around. So I don't feel the need to be polite. And like seeing those, I found very effective, but it's actually just, it's documentation of in-person protest. And I share your, it's clear also that like participating in in-person protest isn't possible for everyone. Like maybe you have like citizenship status or a disability, or even just like, I have like a strange relationship to in-person protest after years of hearing about communal violence. Like I don't always want to, like, I don't always have the kind of, I don't always kind of have the will to go and put my body out there. So I'm sometimes looking for other things, but I do find social media to be unsatisfying. And maybe that's one of the generational divides, one of the fundamental generational divides we're talking about. So in your book, this plays out in really interesting ways between, Minnow, the daughter protagonist in 2018, whose story is primarily in Paris, and her father, Keen, who is at Harvard in the late 60s. And he obviously is operating in an internetless protest environment. And Minnow actually ends up in Paris because she makes a choice to help a student. And I don't want to spoil this, but I guess it happens fairly early on. Minnow makes a choice to help a student who is in trouble in the most old-fashioned sense of that phrase, and faces backlash, including online. and then kind of goes into self-imposed exile-ish in Paris, where she starts witnessing these protests. But so social media has a real impact on her life. And it is one of the things that you can see as differences between the seemingly apolitical father and daughter who end up nevertheless involved in politics. So I'm really curious, because there's so many times and places that you could have chosen to set this story. And as you know, I have a particular soft spot for one of these. Why did you choose Harvard at that time period and the Yellow Vest protests?
You know, there are so many moments, right, that one could have chosen that, and that would have been, I think, equally interesting. But for me, both had a personal resonance, which is my parents were grad students at Harvard in the late 60s. That's where they met. And they're both scientists. In fact, in the book, the chemistry experiment that Keane is doing is the chemistry experiment my mother was doing as a grad student. So I'm not a scientist. I made her tell me all about it. And then I stole those details. But I grew up hearing their stories about sort of being in that milieu at that time, being two scientists in a moment where I think there was a lot of suspicion of science. I mean, there is right now as well. Like, many things haven't changed. But I, what fascinated me the most hearing those stories is that for myself, I mean, my generation, I think, or I won't generalize, I grew up thinking of the 60s as a moment in which we were all poised on the edge of possible idyllic change, right? Like, so many horrible things were happening, you know, but there was a generation-wide galvanization. The fact that you could even have a movement that big and that it could seep into the literature and the film and the politics and the music, that to me was so fascinating, particularly, you know, coming up when I did. We didn't have anything like that, right? Like, the culture had sort of, we went to sleep for a while and then we woke up again is sort of how it felt. But so that was in my mind. And then I mentioned I was raised in a number of different countries. I was born in the States. One of the countries in which I sort of lived multiple times as a child and then later as an adult was France. Always the same neighborhood in Paris, which is actually the neighborhood Minot is staying in, the 5e arrondissement. And so I was back there in 2018 at the very beginning of the Yellow Vest protests, and I stumbled into one without understanding the context that I was walking into. And it was a really fascinating moment for me. I remember I was with my partner and I was with a very close friend that was staying with us. And we had been, we're all, you know, theater people, actor, designer, and then myself. I'm also a playwright when I'm not a novelist. And we had been going to this theater that is very well known called the Théâtre du Soleil. They're a very political organization and a theater in Paris. And so we were walking down the street and we found ourselves in the middle of this vibrant protest. Banners, and the Théâtre du Soleil was present. And so there were these like 7-foot-tall puppets like coming down the street. I mean, it felt amazing. And remember, this is 2018. So, you know, 2020 hadn't yet happened. And the way that America galvanized around protests had not yet happened. And it was the first moment that I had been, again, without understanding context, I was in a place where there was such a diversity of class. There are so many women. There was such, I mean, I was asking questions, so people started to explain what was going on a little bit. And I was talking to professors and truck drivers and people who just, everyone came, it seemed to me, perhaps naively, everyone came from a different background, but they were there because they shared a singular desire for something culturally to shift in that moment. And so, of course, once we left that, I needed to know what it was we had walked into, right? Because if I was reading my own cultural context on what was happening, it became clear to me very quickly, like, I can't understand this with American tools. Like, I have to understand what is happening, what has been happening, such that this is the manifestation of the desire for change.
So your book has appropriately some fantastic protest scenes. And I wonder if you would read a little bit for us.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back.
So I'm going to read a selection from the first chapter. Minho, our protagonist, has stumbled into this protest similar to the one that I stumbled into. And while she is there, when she enters it, there's sort of this, you know, vibrant party vibe. And while she's there, she looks across the crowd and she notices Charles, who is a young teacher. He's teaching at the same university where she has sort of picked up some substitute classes, essentially. And she doesn't know much about him, but she knows that he comes from a very wealthy family, his father's old friends, old school friends with Macron. And that's, I think, all the context that we need. Later, when Minho saw the images on television, armored squads of police as shiny as beetles, the Arc de Triomphe covered in the thick grayish haze of tear gas, she wouldn't recognize them. She had been insulated by the bodies around her and had seen none of what was occurring at the head of the crowd, and so the shift had come from seemingly nowhere. One moment she was standing with the sunlight beating down on the top of her hair. The next, the bodies gathered around her surged forward, wild and panicked. Minho was briefly swept off her feet as a man's shoulder slammed into hers. She pushed at the man's back, but he was being shoved as well. There was no space for his body to fit into that wasn't Minho's space. The thousand disparate bodies had become a single animal fighting itself. Thrown backward, Minho slammed into someone's stomach, found her feet, and then was shunted to the side as the crowd shifted direction. People were trying to run, she realized, but there was nowhere to go, and whatever was happening at the front was translating backward in unforgiving electric pulses, bodies forced this way and that, colliding with each other, stepping on each other. Minho pulled back as an elbow grazed her cheek, a woman losing her balance and falling but never hitting the ground because there was no space in which to do it. Suspended in a crush of strangers, the woman paddled, gasping. Fear sparked in Minho. She turned sideways and started squeezing her way through, but it was impossible. For every gap that opened up, a tidal change would press her in the opposite direction. She wished she had stayed near the lamppost, that she could climb back up it and out of the panicking mob. Someone was screaming, and now more people were screaming, and a strange smell caught the edge of Minho's nostrils, an odd acrid warmth that made her cough. Minho began fighting in earnest, shoving against the wall of thrashing flesh, but she had gotten turned around, and she realized she wasn't sure in what direction she was trying to go. Someone nearby was shouting a warning that caused the bodies around her to crush against each other more tightly, but Minho didn't understand the words, and her head had become wedged against the ribs of a towering man in a camo jacket. The man smelled pungently of cigarette smoke and onions, and then under that was an intensifying gunpowder smell that seemed to be drifting into the cracks between bodies, filling up the small pockets of oxygen with an itch that was beginning to burn. Tear gas, Minho realized. She'd never smelled it before, but it could be nothing else. She started shouting and realized she couldn't hear herself above the chaos around her. The man against whom she was crushed was also bellowing, though she could only tell by the vibration of his ribs against the side of her face. Panic welled inside her. She began kicking out with her feet, making bruising contact with whatever was nearby. She could no longer think of the immutable wall as comprised of other humans. Her elbows were pinned to her sides, but she was kicking and kicking, and then suddenly a sliver of space yawned open, and someone grabbed her wrist and pulled her sideways through it. Gasping, Minho followed the bruising grip, and with a lurch and a groan, she broke through into air. She tripped over the curb of the sidewalk and hit the ground on her knees, choking. Someone grabbed her shoulders, and she looked up, eyes streaming, to see Charles.
The protest meet cute.
The protest meet cute. It's a classic.
I thought that was such a great description of a protest. And also of the feeling of being someone interested in a political subculture or movement, but being kind of on the outside of it and not knowing exactly what's going on. And one of the things that's new to Minho in the moments that you just read is that prospect of real danger. And in the novel, and I mean, it's really like it feels very visceral. And I mean, I was reminded of when I was reading this, I went to Japan last summer, and there was a moment when I was on the subway in Tokyo, and I was like, but there's nowhere to go. I was like, and yeah, and this description kind of felt to me like that. And then both Keen and Minho see violence, and the Paris police used what are called blast balls on the Yellow Vest protesters. And the Yellow Vest protesters, we should say, correct me if I'm wrong here, like I guess I would describe it as like a populist movement where people are gathering approximately like weekly or so to protest things like the cost of living, the price of various goods, and just kind of like their sense that the government was not doing anything to respond to that. And the Paris police using blast balls on people diminished the number of people who were willing to protest because it caused real and serious injuries, like neurological problems, and you depict all of this. And Minow and Keane have different reactions to risk. So I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about how they perceive protest and danger and what they're willing to tolerate at different points in their stories.
Yes. Well, one of the things that I found really fascinating about the Gilets Jaunes or the Yellow Vest movement is that I don't know that we have a great parallel, but the closest one that occurred to me was Occupy, where it was essentially, particularly at the beginning, sort of a leaderless movement. There was a sense that opponents of Occupy thought was the problem, which is that if you asked anybody what do they stand for, you would get a million different answers depending who you asked. But also, I remember being down, you know, with some of the protesters in the park and walking with them. And I was very curious, and hearing them articulate that part of the power of Occupy was that you couldn't sum it up in two sentences, that anything you can sum up in two sentences is sort of the power being centralized in one or two hands immediately lends itself to abuse, right? But that if the point of Occupy is our society has to change, show up whoever you are and participate in that change in whatever way you think is best, that's an open-ended invitation, right? And I think with the Gilets Jaunes movement, particularly in the beginning, and I will say it is not an unfraught movement. I mean, there were many very different groups of people who showed up to walk in the Yellow Vest movement. There's a huge working class conversation to be had. And, you know, some of what they were protesting was that this very, you know, the way the president of France from Paris, from his class background, was, you know, passing laws that were affecting the countryside in ways that were very specific. I don't want to get too far too, you know, I don't want to swerve too far from the question you're asking, but I would say in terms of risk, what Minow falls into is that open-ended invitation, that if the Yellow Vest movement is for anyone and everyone, then it could be for her. And she gets pulled into it because she falls in love with Charles, who, as a child of privilege, as a someone coming from an upper class background, as someone whose father, you know, is an old friend of the president, Macron, Charles reads himself into that context and Minow reads herself after him. And I think for her, the risk and the danger, initially there is a pleasure to it, that she has spent her whole life in some ways being told to be careful. And we'll go to Keane in a moment, her father, but that she has been raised by a man who was so in some ways damaged by his experiences or his view of the world, that his perspective moving forward and raising a daughter was stay safe at all costs. Do not participate. You can't trust crowds. You can't trust politics. You can't trust politicians. Keep your head down. Live a beautiful life. Don't leave your house, essentially. And so as someone being told to be afraid of everything, meeting Charles and meeting a group of people who seem afraid of nothing and willing to risk everything, I think for her is intoxicating. You know, and then, of course, there are moments in which the cost starts to become very personal and very clear, right? For Keane, I think he begins in a way, I mean, he's keeping his head down, he's gotten a deferment from the draft. He's, as you know, which many graduate students, particularly at Harvard, you could get a deferment for a time. He's in the lab, he's working, he's, you know, he believes passionately in the power of science to shift the culture, to shift, science is perhaps his form of activism, although he wouldn't put it that way, but it's his religion, it's his activism, it's the thing that he has to offer. And when he meets and falls in love with Olya, who's a campus organizer, she pulls him into a much more hands-on relationship to the community, you know? I mean, I think I am someone who's fascinated in general by the tensions between the individual and the community and how individuals shift or form or shape their communities and sort of the limits also of our abilities to do that. And I think what is intoxicating for Keane, similarly in some ways to the experience his daughter has, is experiencing the power of believing for the first time that he might be capable of shaping what happens next for the community, for his country, that protesting this war, protesting what is going on, is not just screaming into the void, that you might actually do something. And so I think for both of them, there is an exhilaration to risk. And then for both of them, there are ways in which that risk comes home and comes home very painfully.
It's interesting because as you're talking about Keane, there is a particular moment where he becomes, to his surprise and really everyone's surprise, a speaker for the activists that he's with. And he is the person who, has the mic and delivers a speech that even as he's delivering it, he's very much sort of, I am capable of this. And he becomes, for a brief moment, a little bit of a star and a sort of, like, if social media had been around at that moment, someone definitely would have picked up a phone and, and he would have gone viral for being this eloquent person who is, who has become energized and politicized by his engagement with these issues. So that's a really interesting scene. And it's so much, it's at such great contrast with who we see him being later with his daughter. I mean, everything you said, I feel like things that I've heard from members of older generations and in my family, the kind of, keep your head down, stay home. And the other love story that this book contains, of course, is the one between Keane and Minnow, who care a lot about each other and are at various points very close. But because you've chosen this particular structure, it's so satisfying because, of course, we always know more than them and we can kind of see rhyming action in their choices and then, ways that the themes echo across time. So Keane, as an older man, does seem very different from his younger self. And I wonder if you think that we engage in protest differently across generations, or do we just get older and become more risk averse?
I know a lot of older activists and a lot of older queer activists particularly, so I will resist my own desire to make a blanket statement about, protest and risk for the young. But I will say from what I was interested in interrogating with Keane specifically was a person who believes that risk is worth taking because he believes that in the end he will have had an impact on the world. And not only does he find the world keeps turning and all the things that he thought were terrible and unjust continue to exist, but also, without spoiling the end, he gets pulled into a tragedy of sorts that is unplanned. He makes a series of decisions that have unforeseen consequences. And I think he comes out of that realizing how fallible he is and therefore how fallible other humans are. And by the end of the book, one of the things that he's trying to impart to Minnow is that how can we possibly change society when the building blocks of society are still humans? And regardless of how hard we try, humans are selfish and afraid and weak and incapable of acting without self-interest. This is Keane's perspective, right? But that I think he is, just as he was radicalized by falling in love with Olya and by falling in love with the potential of having power, he is, sort of cynicized or pulverized by the outcome that he encounters, such that he is no longer able to hope for a different future. And being raised by someone who is not able to hope for a different future, I think, is the thing that ultimately Minnow has to be radicalized or chooses to be radicalized against. But this conversation between what happens when someone from one generation has lost the ability to hope and someone from another generation is sort of furiously seeking a thing that will give them hope. And I say furiously because there is some rage against, you know, why didn't you raise me to have any hope, right? Like, that's the tension that really fascinates me. And I have encountered that tension in my own life. I've encountered it inside my family. I think it's hard the more you, and I feel this myself, the longer you live and the more that you see failures stack up, failures of policy, failures of protest, cultural failures, you know, it's hard to maintain an engine of optimism.
Dark, but also, I mean, Keane's a very persuasive character. I was interested in how much sympathy I maintained for him, even as he began to behave in less and less sympathetic ways. Like when Minnow is facing kind of that backlash for helping her student, Keane, sort of, who has guarded his privacy very zealously for some years, one of the things he's angry about is that she has exposed him, that his walls are not high enough, and he had thought that they were, and he's extremely angry at her. And she kind of has a moment where she's kind of wondering, like, why is he not expressing more concern for her, really? And it's this moment of rupture that's really powerful. And that and sort of one of the other tragedies of the story, the way that people are really repeating each other. And how do we? I mean, I think like one of the big questions for me as I was reading this was, I mean, you've written about like what are our mechanisms for change? How do we identify them, and how do we really participate in them? And what does it mean to do that when your hope is not maybe even there? We had Emily Rabiteau, who writes about climate change, on a couple of episodes ago, and she was tweeting recently about people always asking her about hope, and her response was that she was interested in the animating force of anger, which I found. I was like, yes, that's where I go too. But then that's a different kind of exhausting.
Yes. Yes. It's I'm realizing as you're saying that I think something that fascinated me about both Minnow and Keane both is that it was the animating force of love, as you know, that it wasn't necessarily anger, it wasn't necessarily hope, but that each of them is radicalized by falling in love, and that when you fall in love, you see yourself differently. You see the person across from you differently. Like, there's a way in which you start to read a whole new possibility into your environment, even if, you know, perhaps it would be short-lived. I don't know. But that the sort of the sexual awakening and the political awakening for each of them, the one triggers the other, right?
Which is, in some ways, like, maybe almost a trope of literature about movements. And yet also, like, I think it's a trope because it's often accurate. Like, I think about what I wrote my journalism school thesis about, literature of the weather underground. And you would often see this kind of play out in some of that literature.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back.
It was interesting to see Minnow make really distinctive choices and to feel that she had a lot of agency as a character, because I don't know, that's often what I want for, I want women characters or femme characters to have some power, but she is also very much at the mercy of the things around her and very much swayed by this emotion for the very charismatic Charles. I don't know. Charles comes on the page, and I was like, "Oh God, he's so hot." I was like checking my watch. I was like, "That's going to happen. When is that going to happen?" So I was rude.
And this is the thing. The engine, I think the engine of anger has some staying power. The engine of hope definitely has staying power. But the engine of falling in love is complicated. Because it can propel you, I think, in ways that are, you know, like all of a sudden, I mean, with Minnow at least, all of a sudden there's a moment of, wait, where did I get myself?
And I think maybe right? Not for Keen as much. But I mean, Olya also, like, she appears in a very striking way that I won't spoil. But I could imagine the film. And she appears on the page, and I was like, she's also hot. I was, you know, she's so charismatic. And then I was like, and this is why we sometimes get, you know, you're drawn to listen to someone, perhaps because maybe being politicized is like falling in love, that you become entranced with a subject such that you're willing to study it and look at its different angles and argue its pros and cons. And I was glad that... that there was a woman's point of view and a man's point of view, so that I wasn't thinking about. I think often the trope actually is, I feel like maybe I'm quoting Dana Spiota, but like when you write about activism and there's like a young woman who has a political awakening, and is it just because of some guy? And like, is that kind of frustrating? But I love how this book complicates that in so many ways, like because of Charles's class status and his family background and his own uncertainty about his position and authenticity as an activist, the age gap, Minnow's very particular history. It becomes such a specific and believable and alive relationship. I just really appreciated it. Everyone should go and buy this book. It's so good. I want to ask you perhaps one final question, venturing back into the dark territory where Keen just took us, being somewhat jaded. If the novel is about people's personal politics and how we engage in activism, but it's also about how we navigate our relationships among those generational divides. So generational divides seem to me like one of the things that is holding us back at present. And maybe not because of a Keen-like jadedness, but sometimes because of like a thirst for profit, or perhaps like a very subconscious notion that, well, I won't be around when the earth is burning, so I don't have to worry about it. So why do generational divides in activism and politics persist even in the face of such overwhelming challenges that you would think would maybe bring people together? And given our changing relationship to risk and hope, how should we encourage present and future generations to engage with the failures of past generations? It's a softball.
Oh, I wish I knew the answer to that. I mean, that's the key, right? I think that I'm holding two thoughts in my head at once, and one is the necessity of naming the failures of previous generations and having your own generational failures named clearly. And then the other thought is that it is easy to assign blame when you name a failure. And I think some of what the book is trying to interrogate is, is it a sign of failure that we are still protesting the things that our parents and grandparents are protesting? Did they simply not go far enough? Did they not do it well enough? Did they not save us from having to be where we are? Or did they give us tools? Did they give us precedents? Did they give us language that we would not otherwise have? And it is okay that the wheel of the world has turned and we are in this place still fighting for this thing. Or if okay is not the right word, it is human that we are here. But perhaps another one of the tools or gifts that the previous generations gave us was an understanding of why they failed, why it didn't go farther. What were the constraints, and how can we continue to push against those constraints, right? Like I am trying to hold those two thoughts for myself in this moment also, in this moment particularly, in which I think I feel a lot of frustration and bewilderment, and I look around me and it feels like we are living in the middle of the apocalypse. But also, I don't remember which volume it was, but one of Virginia Woolf's diaries not that long ago, just sort of flipping through it, and I landed on this entry where she was talking about a dinner party she had gone to with a group of friends, and she was sort of relaying the conversation, and the entire conversation, this was 1936, I think, the entire conversation was about how nothing has ever been this bad. World War II hadn't even happened yet. And they were sitting, I guess actually it was lunch, not dinner. They were sitting at lunch and they were discussing how they were on the edge of the end of the world, right? And so in some ways, I think, well, if Virginia felt like that then, like, again, two thoughts. We are in the middle of the apocalypse, and perhaps we are always in the middle of the apocalypse, right? And what do we do with that? How do we take those tools? Like,
well, I think, yeah, one of the great things that I felt like I got from your book was afterwards, yeah, the feeling that I don't know, I wanted to go and cheer extra hard for those young climate disruption activists, the ones who were going to the fundraisers and yelling at the top of their lungs, and to fight down any defensiveness I have, which I think is definitely present, like at anyone addressing me as a version of the man. Which, I mean, I must be the man to someone, but to kind of just try to, yeah, to cheer for the progress and the different strategies with the tools that they have from learning from our failures and the failures before ours, and maybe that's actually a very cheerful
shockingly.
Jen, thank you so much. Congratulations on publication of There's Going to Be Trouble. We really
thank
appreciate
you so
your
much
being
for
with us.
Having me here and for reading the book. I really appreciate it.
Listeners, don't miss There's Going to Be Trouble, which is available now in an independent bookstore near you.
That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. This podcast is produced by Anne Kniggendorf. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. Please go give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done it yet. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the Lit Hub Radio tab. We'll also post that show page with links to the books we referenced this week on Facebook at FNF Pod, on Twitter at FNF Talk, on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. You can find video of our interviews at our own Fiction Nonfiction Podcast YouTube channel and IGTV channel and on our website at fnfpodcast.net, where our back episodes are grouped by topic areas. Happy reading!